Okay, next slide then, Sandy. I did notice that coming up on the Wednesday before Christmas and Christmas Eve itself, there's a TV series with David Suchet, Mr. Hercule Poirot, maybe more well-known, looking at Paul, in the footsteps of Paul, a two-part series tracing Paul's footsteps. It's on the BBC. I believe it's 9 o'clock in the morning, so I think it's going to be fairly okay. Nothing too controversial going on there. But, yeah, it might encourage people to take a look at that and see. And seems like quite a good retelling of the story of Paul. There, let's get this sorted out. Is that better? Okay. Maybe that's better. Maybe that's not. Okay. So, that's the little plug there. What I'd like to do now, I noticed, and I think Alan was agreeing with this when we were chatting about it before, that there's a bit of a bias. If you come along in a morning service, and it happened this morning actually, there's lots of chocolate being given out. I thought I'd address that. I know that might be nice. It's your chance to maybe start opening the packet. So I'd like to do a little, as part of a little recap, a little quiz. So next slide. This isn't working, is it? Okay, so not quite Call My Bluff, but next slide, Sando. It's Pull My Bluff. So very good. And if you think that's bad, you should hear the other alternatives that I tried to come up with my dad and brother yesterday at lunchtime. That's by far the best one. So just a few little questions to see what we remember about Paul and his journey. Firstly, how many books is it commonly said that Paul wrote of the Bible? Anyone is going to be a hands up shouting out? Anyone want to take a guess? It has been mentioned a couple of times in the series. Or you can very quickly work it out. I see some counting of fingers. Anyone want to take a guess? A little bit higher. 13. Give the man a choice of sweet. Oh dear. Can you... Okay. Thank you very much. Sorry about that, Alan. Okay, so how many, and we'll go to the nearest 100 for this, how many miles did Paul travel across his three missionary journeys and his trip up to Rome at the end, we've just read about the end of? How many miles? And I'll maybe take sort of three answers and we'll see who gets the closest on this one. So the nearest 100. We're talking quite large numbers here. Anyone want to start us off? Sorry? 25,000. A little bit lower. That's not too far up. Anyone? Sorry? 5,000. Does anyone want to have another guess, maybe, in the middle? No, we'll go, you were the closest, I suppose, out of that. So it's 10,000 miles, I reckon. Someone's actually worked it out to 10,282. Because we have quite an accurate list in Acts of all the places he visited, so it's possible that it can be worked out. Okay, how many days across those journeys did he just spend travelling? So not the times he was waiting or resting or whatever else he was doing in between, but how many days did he spend travelling across those three journeys and the time up to Rome? We'll take to the nearest 10 days if anyone wants to have some guesses. Any guesses? There's quite a few. 100, a bit more maybe? Anyone? Somewhere between those two. Oh, AJ, almost. 281. You get the sweet. Well done. Finally, so how many years elapsed from the beginning of his first missionary journey till the time he was taken up to Rome that we've just read about in the passage here? So there was a bit of a time after this, some other things, a couple of years in Rome, but from the beginning of the first journey to the time he was taken up to Rome, how many years? Any guesses? Very close. So I'll give you that one, actually. 14 years. 14 years. So AD 46 was his first journey, finished in AD 57, and then AD 60, apparently, was when he was taken up to Rome. And I will put the sweets out for everyone else. I don't want people to feel left out. So they will be there with the coffee at the end. You can... I've eaten too much chocolate already. Yes, just so people don't feel left out, that thinking it's just kids in the morning service to get all the sweets. But the serious part of that is to really have a look at the effort. So we read about Paul's hardship, and I think we kind of get that, but actually just the journey on its own. And it talks, and there's even other stuff about how much it would have cost and how many, the equivalent of how many, is possibly 6.5 years, depending how you work it out, of day's labour to pay the cost of his journeys. So there's a lot of stuff going on here. Paul went to a big effort to do this, thousands of miles, hundreds of days over many years to do his journey. And we end up in Acts 28. But I just want to very briefly, thanks Andy, take a look back through this series. We started back in the end of July, so I guess almost 5 months ago. And these are the sort of headings. You can maybe play a little game of who was the preacher each night or which bit of Acts and things like that. But I will just go through a few of them. I'm not going to go through all of them because many of you were here for almost all of these, so I'm not going to go over it again. But it is a very quick plug for our wonderful tech team who have been helpful tonight. But these are all available as downloads on our website, and I find it, I don't know if anyone else does, I find it very helpful sometimes to listen back to some of these on my commute to work or when I'm washing up or whatever. And that resource is available. And particularly when we've done a series like this and if there's parts you've missed out and some of these not familiar because you weren't here that week, maybe that's an opportunity to go back. So it started with John way back in July, looking at the chief of sinners, how Paul proclaimed himself the chief of sinners, and or the worst of sinners is another way he talked about it. And Paul realised he was a sinner, and he come from this real tricky background, this situation of when he was Saul and all the things he did then, but he moved into what he became when he was Paul. And the challenge was really that we're all sinners and we need to understand that. And Paul did this amazing, had this amazing transformation, but it meant that he really appreciated grace. And do we appreciate grace in the same way? And then actually on to the one Alan did the week after, the conversion of Paul. And there's two parts to it. One is looking at how we can have a tailor-made conversion. And Saul to Paul's conversion was tailor-made for him. And God met him in that way. But the other part that's maybe more relevant to most of us is Ananias, maybe the hidden, unsung hero of this. And the work he did in passing the baton on. What Ananias did to make Paul's conversion possible, the risks he took going to speak to Paul, the way he listened to God, the way he's honest with God maybe about his struggles with wanting to do this. But the main thing that he did was accept Paul, and was probably the first person that accepted Paul after he'd gone through his conversion, his first Christian, who accepted him that way, knowing how he would have been before. We also went through some other topics about commissioning and Terry talked to us about how we really need to understand what our calling, our commissioning is, and that fits in, I think, with the idea of passing on the baton. We can't begin to look at how we might pass on the baton if we don't know what our calling is going to be, if we don't know what our ministry is meant to be. And Terry gave us the challenge of that we all have a calling, and do we know what our calling is? Are we working on our calling? Are we trying to understand our calling? And we worked through some others and arrived at the Gentiles. Perhaps the clearest example of Paul looking to pass on the baton or get the word out to a new set of people. And Paul Abeta, the Paul from our church, talked to us about how they had this key idea around, they were trying to put circumcision as an extra requirement around becoming a Christian, and how that was resolved, and looking at how we can get an example for resolving conflict in that. And then a bit further on, Matthew Scott talked about how Paul was very, very good and very clear about wanting to meet people where they're at and understand where they're at before he talked to them. And then the example in Corinth and the tombs of unknown gods and all the stuff he did around that, where Paul first talked to them in a way they would understand and then moved the message on to the gospel as we might understand. And how being all things to all men in that heading there, it's really key if we're going to have any chance of being effective talking to people about the gospel, talking to people about our faith. We need to look at and try and understand where they're at. And then on to near the end, the resurrection and all the things, the arguments in Corinthians about if the resurrection is false, what that means for our faith. And because we believe that the resurrection is true, the flip side of what that means for our faith, and how we can that can then give us the hope to hold on to, or give us the reason for passing the baton on, and all these things. So actually, as you look back through the series, there is all the things that Paul's doing to spread the gospel and spread the word of Christ to different people. But he also takes a lot of time, particularly in where he's writing his books, to look to pass the baton on, to look to equip those churches or individuals in the case of Timothy. And that's as part of what he does as well. There's a comedian that I quite like, and his whole routine is based around basically being a fairly grumpy old man, and he talks about how he doesn't like technology and how he, you know, basically almost hates the world. I'm sure in real life he's actually quite a nice person, good to be with, but if he's anything, his on-stage persona is quite different. And in part of one of his acts, he does all these jokes about how he likes to wind people up and basically annoy people for his own amusement, which on one level is not great, but it is actually quite funny to listen to. And he ends with talking about, the joke goes a little bit like this. So he's saying, "For me, nothing can replace the joy of reading a real book." And you're like, "You sound like quite a grumpy person. I don't know why you'd want to read a book." But he goes on, "You get to the end of it, tear out the last 5 pages and take it to the charity shop." I don't know if any of you are people who buy books from charity shops. I would be mortified if I'd gone to the charity shop, seen a book I liked, you know, got it for 99p or whatever the going rate is, took it home, you know, read through it, maybe kept me a couple of weeks, and you get to the ending and the last 5 pages are missing. I don't think you'd think to check. Maybe you're going to do that next time you buy a book from a charity shop. But despite it being a bit of a joke, and you never know with comedians how much they really do, we kind of get that bit of sense of that's what's going on with the end of Acts. And Alan alluded to it there, that Acts ends in this quite abrupt way. Certainly if we'd been following through, if we were to sit down and read through Acts, we'd have the narrative that we'd seen a little bit on the previous slide of some of the things that Paul encountered along the way. And if we were following the story of Paul through there, we would kind of know what was coming. We'd have some idea where things were supposed to go. We know he's on a journey, we know he's been to Jerusalem, we know his ultimate destination is Rome, and he's working his way to there. We kind of have an idea of why he's working his way up to there. But we get to the end of the book and we might sort of try turning the pages. Where's Acts 29? What's going on? Why does the story end this way? How does it end for Paul? How does things happen when he gets to Caesar? In this passage, and also a little bit back in Acts 25, this is when he appeals to Caesar, his right as a Roman citizen to have this trial before Caesar, and he appeals to that, and that kicks off the process of him being transported to Rome, where we see him in Acts 28. And also, if you have your Bibles open at Acts 28, if you want to flick back to Acts 23, it's page 1120. We kind of get the explanation of why he's headed to Rome, why he's so set on getting to Rome, what the reasonings behind it is. Acts 23:11 says this: "The following night, the Lord stood near Paul and said, 'Take courage. As you have testified about me in Jerusalem, so you must also testify in Rome.'" So Paul had this clear idea. He wasn't heading to Rome for the fun of it or because he thought it would be a good idea, and it clearly wasn't going to be a great experience. And we know that things end with his death a bit later on. Like Alan said, there's some historical books around that talk to some of this, and we know after the period at the end of Acts 28, we know that a few years later there's Paul's death, and there's maybe educated guess is the best explanation of like how it... which Caesar would have been around and some of the circumstances, but we don't know for sure. But I think it's interesting to try and have a look at why Acts ends like it does, why the story doesn't end with the story, if you like, why the narrative of Paul doesn't finish with the ultimate ending of his life or his meeting with Caesar. Now, all of these things are kind of... maybe educated guess is a bit unfair on them, but when you read around, people have obviously spent some time trying to come up with this. So they are sort of theories, but they give us some interesting ideas. So one of the first ones that comes up is that maybe Acts was written as part of Paul's trial. When he was going to go on trial before Caesar, maybe Luke was writing Acts as a way to form a defence that could be presented at his trial. And actually, if you look back through it, it's very thorough on what Paul did, on very thorough on where Paul went, what he was up to, why he did the things he did, his motivation, all these sorts of things. It's very clear on that as we go through Acts. So that would fit, maybe. And it would explain why it ended before his trial, if it formed part of this trial. Another idea is that maybe it makes us question and wonder why. Maybe like me, when you read through it, and Alan as well, that you get to it, you think, actually, why does it end that way? And it starts you thinking off, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. Not many other books of the Bible end in that way. It's kind of strange compared to other books. So you're kind of thinking, what's the reason? And it gets, and so the idea, whether that was a deliberate thing or maybe it was a byproduct of the author of the book, but maybe it's that's the reason. Maybe to make us ensure that the focus is on God and not on Paul. If it had carried on with the story of Paul's life, not that Paul's not worthy of following and studying, and that's why we've taken this time to do this in the evening service, but Paul's not Jesus. Paul's not God. Paul's a human. Paul's a human who had an extraordinary life and was extraordinarily committed to God, but he's a human. And maybe if it went too much into looking at his death and those sorts of things, it might take the focus off God. And in fact, the last verse of Acts 28 now, in Acts 28, verse 31, talks about Paul proclaiming, but it talks about how he proclaimed the Lord Jesus Christ. So the book ends with the focus on God, with Paul proclaiming God. And maybe part of it is actually we're being shown that the spreading of gospel doesn't end with Paul. Maybe it's a kind of hint or a nudge to us that actually the work isn't done. Paul did a fantastic job of kicking things off. He started moving the message outside of the Jews and all the things that went with that when it first was spoken to the Gentiles. He preached the message in Europe probably for the first time and spread it into the continent that we're part of 2,000 years later. So he did a fantastic job of kicking things off and was chosen. We talked about when Paul, one of the sermons before, when he was chosen, he was the right person to do that job. There was very specific things that I believe Alan went through when he talked about it that meant he was really suited to do that job. So he was chosen for that role. But that role didn't finish. We can't just sit back and say, well, Paul did it, it's all okay. You know, the gospel's been spread as far as it needs to and we haven't got a job to do. So maybe that's part of it. And I think, for me, that I see that actually one of the things that Paul did in those last 2 years, and we read about in Acts, it's the one bit he does tell us about the 2 years where he's under house arrest. One of the things he did was write at least the letter to Timothy and maybe others. And so whilst he couldn't go out, whilst he was under house arrest, he did everything he could to continue spreading the gospel. He would talk to anyone who would come and meet him, and he would also write letters to some of the people. And that, to me, speaks to this idea of passing on the baton. Whatever his situation, he was still doing everything he could. He couldn't go to these places anymore. He was under arrest. He couldn't go and pass on the baton in a physical way, but he still wanted to encourage people. So passing on the baton, as we can see here, sometimes it goes a little bit wrong. I'll let it run through one more time. It's hard to work out, actually, in this case, who's at fault. And maybe that you can see at the end, they're just about to start their polite discussion about whose fault it was and what went on. But if you're not into athletics, basically, they're now disqualified from the race. So that could be 2 years of training or more down the pan and on a dropping of a baton. If you flick onto the next one, this is roughly what it's supposed to look like if you're not into athletics at all. There's supposed to be a bit of communication. There's supposed to be a coordinated bit where one person's holding out their hand and the other one receives it. And then, so you're not supposed to slow down and all those sorts of things. So that's what it's supposed to look like when it works. Okay, flick on the next one. Thanks, Andy. Yeah, that's good. Thank you. So passing on the baton, those are the little videos that, whilst they're funny to look at, they do have a bit of a, give us some pointers that we'll come to in a minute. But I wanted to look what Paul did in his example, particularly to Timothy. It's one of the few books that Paul writes to an individual as opposed to an entire church, and clearly had a relationship with Timothy, and he was very specific about some of the things he talked to Timothy about in this time. He was taking his last opportunity, if you like, to speak to Timothy while he still could. So I'd like you to flick back, on in your pew Bibles, page 1197, 2 Timothy chapter 4. Timothy chapter 4. And we're just going to look through a few verses of some of the very clear and practical things that Paul speaks to Timothy and can be really good, clear examples to us. Firstly, in verse 2, he's very clear that we need to be preaching the word. That's probably easy for me to stand at the front, but I don't think it's limited to just preaching the word in the way we call a preacher. There's much more to it than that. We can be preaching the word when we're in a home group, explaining the Bible to the other people in the home group. We can be preaching the word when we talk to a non-Christian about the Bible. Particularly this time of year, I think there's quite a unique opportunity with Christmas. It's one of the times of the year when people actually have something religious in their mind, in their mindset. Despite all the attempts of shops and commercials to get in the way, there is still in people's minds, I think, a little bit of the real meaning of Christmas. And we can have a chance to have conversations with people about what that involves, what we make of Christmas, why Christmas for us isn't just the presents and the food and the chocolates and the meals with family and all those things, why Christmas for us is something a bit more. And we actually have that opportunity that we maybe don't have at other years, where people might actually be thinking about that before we start the conversation off. So Paul's commanding Timothy to preach the word. He's also talking again in verse 2 about being prepared in season and out of season, a bit further on in verse 2. This, I think, really speaks to the idea that this is a continuous thing. This isn't something we just do for certain periods of our lives and then not in other periods. Paul could have got to Rome under house arrest and sort of said, well, you know what, I've done the bit, I've got here. There's a hard bit coming up when I actually face the trial, but I'm going to take a bit of time. I'm going to rest. I'm going to relax. Yes, he was limited in what he could do because he's under house arrest, but you don't get the impression that he slowed up in his passion for these things. You don't get the impression that he was taking as much time as he could to speak to people. So there's this idea about being prepared in season, out of season, taking whatever opportunities we have. If you hear the other week, we had the sermon that was timed, I think it's become known as now, and this idea that we don't know the timings of things. We don't know. And Andy alluded to it this morning when his clever diagram of Jesus has come and Jesus is coming again. We don't know the timings of these things. We can't always say, well, I'll do this in a few years' time when my life is more calm, settled down, or I'll do this in a few years' time when I've got more of an understanding of things. We have to take these opportunities, be prepared in season and out of season. Also, Paul is very clear to Luke about, of Timothy about correcting, rebuking, and encouraging, again in verse 2, and with the added part, with great patience and careful instruction. What are we like on correcting, rebuking, and encouraging? It's both things. I don't necessarily think any people would find any of those things particularly easy. Even sometimes it's hard to encourage people, let alone the tougher ones. But there's an idea that as Christians, in love and through love, sometimes we do have to correct and rebuke other Christians. But also, let's not forget encouragement. Do we encourage each other as much as we should do? Do we take the time to deliberately go up to someone and thank them for something they did? Or deliberately write a note to someone to say, that thing that you're doing, I know you're struggling with it, but keep going with it. Do we do that? Are we encouraging each other? He also talks a bit further on in verse 5, keeping your head in all situations. Kind of the idea that there's going to be tough times. There's going to be times when people might make us angry. There's going to be times when we're not sure what to say, those sorts of things, and keeping our head, thinking things through, discussing things with other Christians sometimes, not letting our anger get in the way of things, being able to put aside our differences, all these sorts of things it speaks to. Again, also in verse 5, he's very clear that that Timothy will need to endure hardship. And the same applies to us. And I'm not going to go into that because Andy talked to that really, I found it really powerfully the 2 weeks ago, the sermon when Andy talked about hardship and suffering. And if that's something that you struggle with, I really encourage you to take a look at that sermon if you weren't here. He also talks to Timothy that to do the work of an evangelist. Maybe we see these evangelists on TV, the televangelists or the ones that come around and we think, you know, that's not for me. Yes, we're not all called to be that person who can speak in front of thousands of people and explain the gospel in that type of way. But we are all called to evangelize in a more personal way, on a one-to-one situation. Talk to our neighbours, our friends, our work colleagues. Do the work of an evangelist. And we've been looking over a large part of this year at Matthew in the morning service. And the last verse of Matthew 28, verse 19, says this: "Therefore go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you. And surely I am with you always to the very end of the age." We're commanded by Jesus to do some of these things as well. And his promise that he's with us while we do it. And one of the last things that Paul commands Timothy, verse 5, discharge all the duties of your ministry. It's a great sort of catch-all, you know. All the duties, everything is your ministry. But that implies that we know what our ministry is. We have to have some idea what we're supposed to be doing, what our ministry involves. That's different for everyone. What I'm supposed to be doing is different than what Dave on the piano is supposed to be doing. And probably if I go and play the piano, it's not going to help things. I need to understand what my ministry is and what my skills are and what God's given me to do. And the same for Dave. And we have to discharge all the parts of our ministry. Sometimes we might end up in a case of ministry where there's bits we like and bits we really struggle with. But if we believe we're doing that for God, this is talking about how we need to do all these things, not just the easy bits, not just the bits that give us the most pleasure, not just the bits that we find we get the most acceptance for, but the tough bits, the hard bits as well. So, final part, passing on the baton. We've seen in the little videos earlier on how it can go a bit wrong, but one thing they do speak to in a more serious way is that actually there's kind of two parts involved in passing on the baton. At some points in our lives, we actually need to be prepared to receive the baton. We might be the one who the baton is being passed on to, if that makes sense. I don't just want to limit it to like when we're young or when we're a younger Christian, but that tends to be the way we think about it. But it can, I think these things can happen at different times throughout our lives. When I was at university, I had a time, I guess, where I was discipled, or if you look at it like this, someone was spending some time passing the baton on to me. It was a guy called Nathan. He was a couple of years above me in university. He was in my home group, and he was my home group leader. And there's clear times I can remember now, quite a few years later, where we sat down and he talks through stuff with me, helped me with things I was struggling with. And I really felt for me, at that time of university, God put him in my path, in my social circles, however it ended up, so that he was the one, other people were involved as well, but I see as someone who really helped me in that time of university where I'd moved away from my home church, moved away from all my friends, was in a different situation. And looking back, I can see that he had that role. I don't know if he was ready to accept that role, but he did a good job of doing that, and I'm very grateful for that looking back now. But then there's been other times. I've done... Then after university, I moved back to the church here and I was involved in a lot of the youth work. And there's actually a time when I was mentoring a young person. And I guess I need to be a bit careful because his dad's sitting there and his mum's sitting over there. So I'll be careful. No, there's nothing to say that they could upset them. He's a great kid. He's not a kid now, is he? He's a great young man. But I had that period where I was in that role of looking to, in some way, pass the baton, not to take anything away of the work that his parents had done for 16 years. I came in at the end and just did a tiny little bit to help, and hopefully did help, but that moved in that way. And then now I've been in situations where people decide for me, and I look to people to get advice or things like that. So these things change. I just want to make the point is it's not always thinking that when we get to a certain age, we're then okay to pass the baton on and that sort of thing. These things change through our lives. There might be times where we're the ones needing the advice and help, and there might be times where we have to make that effort, and the things might even be happening at the same time. We might be getting guidance from someone about how we can give guidance to other people. So that's my challenge for all of us as we end here, as we end this series of Paul, all the things that have been going on there. So we look back at what Paul did. Lots and lots of things he did. I'm not going to recap them again for all of you. But he did spend quite a lot of time looking to pass on the baton in whatever way he could, individually to people, to entire churches, setting up all the things that we can read about in Acts and all those sort of things. And my challenge for all of us is, what are we doing in our role of passing on the baton? Are we in a time where we need to have some of that receiving, or is it a time we need to do our job of passing it on? Terry's quote from a few weeks ago stuck with me about how the church is only ever one generation from being extinct, if you like. And that's not happened. God's working to make sure that doesn't happen. But we have a part to play in that. How are we passing on the baton? Thank you.